Sorry, are you going to go halfway forward and then halfway back?
that's the idea. The slides are exactly symmetric.
I'm just checking the number of participants and when the stabilize, we can start. Okay, maybe it's 5 past. Maybe we can start. What do you say, Lucy?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so it's a pleasure to have today Lucian Hardy as our speaker in the Quantum Foundation seminar. And I guess Lucian needs no introduction here. And the topic of his talk is time symmetry and operational theories.
Okay, thanks very much. So this drawing was done by my younger daughter, because I was talking about time symmetry all the time, so she did a drawing to go with it. The talk was based on a paper. It's quite a long paper. It's 149 pages, so it's one day I would learn how to write short papers, but it's difficult sometimes to say everything you want to say in a short paper. In any case, this talk, I won't be able to cover everything that's in the paper, so I'll just highlight some of the main points. Okay. So, first of all, standard operational quantum theory is like this. So you have these constraints. I call them physicality constraints. They dictate what operators are allowed. And there are two constraints on operators. One is that the operator should be completely positive. So in one notation, this condition can be written like this. This underscore, this T under here, can either stand for tester, which is where you place a kind of tester device around this and check that everything is positive. I'll explain what that means later. Or it stands for partial transpose, where you take the partial transpose of the operator either on the input or the output space, it doesn't matter which, and then you're looking for the positivity of the operator after you've taken that partial transpose. So you have the complete positivity condition, and this condition is time symmetric. Then you have another condition that operations should be trace non-increasing. This condition relates to what I call the Pavia causality condition, that the deterministic effect is unique. And a way of representing this condition diagrammatically is what I've drawn here. So if you have an operation, an operator here, and you ignore operation, so basically you ignore what happens in the future, then what you get should be less than or equal to what would happen if you just ignored the input system. And you can see from this diagram that this condition is time asymmetric. So there's a problem here. The operational quantum theory is time asymmetric. I should say, by the way, I'm happy to take questions during the talk, especially when we're in this format. It's nice to have questions during the talk. Okay, so
Lucian, can I ask a question?
So first Ding and then Lee.
The question is, why do you think it's a problem that there's some time asymmetric part of the operational quantum theory?
Why do I think it's a problem? So I'll come on to that on the next slide.
Okay.
And Lee, you had a question.
Is this basically saying that decoherence can only increase?
No, I don't think it isn't specifically to do with decoherence. It's saying that probability cannot. Well, okay. So I think there's some history here. So the trace non-increasing condition was known for a long time, but people didn't really connect it with time symmetry or time asymmetry. And that's just saying that the probability, the total probability should be shouldn't increase. Mm-hmm. So not the total probability. The probability associated with given outcome shouldn't increase. So you know, if you have some process that has property one, and then you condition, and then you have some outcome, the probability associated with that outcome should be less than or equal to one. Yeah. So this is what that's saying. So a density matrix, you know, before, if it's normalized, so the trace is one, then afterwards it should be it shouldn't be super normalized. Yeah. But then there's another part of this condition, another way of thinking about this, which is to do with causality. Here, if you imagine, if this B box has no outcomes, then this inequality is saturated, and then you just have equality between these two halves. And what that's telling you is that if you ignore the future, it basically is telling you that the operation of ignoring the future is unique. So here you have this compound box where you have B, then you ignore the future. And that should be the same in this case as just ignoring the future.
Yes.
And that's related to causality, though. If you're not conditioning on anything in the future, then choices you make in the future shouldn't affect probabilities in the past.
Okay.
Okay. So that's I think is the sort of deep content of this. And of course, under that interpretation, it's time asymmetric because you know, you're talking about the future not influencing the past, but not vice versa.
Lucien, can I ask one more question?
Please go ahead, Joe.
So I'm imagining that you're evaluating this time symmetry versus time asymmetry by kind of imagining the adjoint of the superoperator as being its time inverse. So like the adjoint of the superoperator relative to the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, because a complete positive map's adjoint is also a complete positive map, but one that's trace non-increasing, its adjoint only needs to be unital and might not be.
I'm going to use a different sort of language because I prefer to use a sort of operator tensor language than those kind of languages. I think it's more suited to this discussion of time symmetry. But I think some of what you're saying is correct. But maybe let me get to that kind of point in the development.
You're going to give us a definition of what it is for something to be time symmetric. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me get to that.
Point
of, okay. Okay, so the time asymmetry is odd for various reasons. So here are three reasons. So first of all, abstract probability theory doesn't care about time direction. It just concerns conditional probabilities. And nothing tells you that when you condition, when you have a property like X given Y, that Y has to be in the past. That's just a choice. So abstract probability theory knows nothing about time as such. So point one. Point two, quantum theory at the level of the Schrodinger equation is time symmetric. So it's odd that you end up getting this time asymmetric operational theory out of that. Point three, the quantum theory of measurement can be treated very simply without reference to the second law. So you might think, well, the origin is the second law, but actually there's a very simple von Neumann model for measurement, which doesn't invoke the second law of thermodynamics and it accounts for all the quantitative features of measurement. You can model measurement perfectly well in this von Neumann model, even if real measurement apparatuses are kind of messy and entropic considerations might be relevant. Nevertheless, there are these models using the von Neumann model where you don't need to invoke the second law. So it's to some extent it can't be the second law that's forcing this. Okay, so I'm going to show you how to fix the time asymmetry. First of all, you have to go right back to the very beginning, and look at the basic concepts. So especially operations. So let me talk about what an operation is. So an operation corresponds to one use of a piece of apparatus in a laboratory, and usually it's represented by a box. And the box has coming into it these inputs, which might be quantum systems, and outputs going out, which are can be quantum systems as well. I should say this: the discussion in for most of this talk will be at the general level of operational theories, and then I will specialize to quantum theory at the end. So these inputs, they can be quantum systems in that application, and the outputs too. And then you also have settings, so you choose some knob settings, for example, and then you have outcomes. And the outcome is where you read off a meter, for example, the position of a pointer or some detector lights, detectors click, some lights flash. So the settings and the outcomes are classical. The inputs and the outputs are for the physical systems that you're interested in. So, for example, quantum systems. If you look at this more carefully, you can see there's a kind of asymmetry, time asymmetry, because the settings are available both before and afterwards. So if you have a knob setting, you can see the knob setting before, and you can also see it afterwards. Whereas the outcomes are available afterwards, but they're not available before. So now you can see the standard notion of an operation is actually time asymmetric. And so if you start with this notion, it's going to be very difficult to make a time symmetric version of quantum theory. However, it's quite easy to see how to fix it. You just need to add another arrow, and you need to name that arrow. So I've called it an income. So you now have incomes, things that come in, and outcomes, and then you also still have the settings. And so the idea is that the outcomes are available after the operation, but not before, in some sense. Incomes are available before the operation, but in some sense not afterwards. Rob, I can see you have your hand raised.
It's what distinguishes an income from an input and an outcome from an output.
So in the first place, incomes and outcomes are classical, whereas inputs and outputs might not be classical. However, you could also have some classical inputs and outputs. So then it's more sort of about the sort of role they play in how you use them in the experiment. So incomes and outcomes are going to correspond to the things you sort of note. So in particular, you'd be interested in the joint probabilities over some incomes and outcomes, for example. So they play a certain role in the way you analyze your experiment that inputs and outputs don't play.
So both are necessarily classical.
And they are necessarily classical, yes.
Okay.
Ding.
It's a similar question. What distinguishes a setting and income and outcome?
So that's actually a great question, which I think requires more thought than what I have in the paper. Despite the fact that the paper is 149 pages, I think I haven't properly addressed that question in the paper. However, at this level of discussion, settings are something which is available before and after. So an example might be the setting of a magnetic field. You might choose a certain value for that magnetic field by orienting some electromagnetic coil in a certain direction. And then you can look at that setting, and you can see what the setting is both before and afterwards. It's information that's available before and afterwards. An income might correspond to choosing an ancilla, preparing an ancilla in one of a certain basis. In one of a certain basis set, so you kind of use up the ancilla, and you can't read it out afterwards. So there's some sense in which it's not available afterwards. And an outcome is not available before. You can't see the result of the outcome before. I think there's more to this discussion than just that, but perhaps I can leave it at that for the time being.
I see. That clarifies. Just one more question. Is the setting have to be classical?
Yeah, I would say yes in this framework. However, on the next slide, I'm about to delete the setting arrow because it's not going to be the main focus of what I'm talking about. But yes, I would say it has to be classical. So there we are. I deleted the setting arrow. So I want to focus on incomes and outcomes. And now I take the setting to be implicit in the choice of the symbol A. So if you had a different setting, you'd use a different symbol A, a different symbol here. Okay. And then just to use some notation here, So I'll use, I forget what the name of this font is. This is /MathTT typeface, I think. Typeface font to represent the incomes and outcomes. And I'll use bold sans serif font to represent the inputs and outputs. The incomes and outcomes, I'll take them to take certain values, classical values. So the X and Y are the types. Typeface, and then if I use the normal X and Y here, then that actually pertains to a particular value. So the value might be 1, 2, up to some value n. Okay. So that's just some notation. So you can wire operations together. So here's here's a circuit with the wires. These operations are wired together. So when we have no open wires, I say that's a circuit. And then we're going to be interested in joint probabilities, the probability in this example, the probability of X and the probability of Y and the probability of Z. So this is a joint probability of the form P incomes, comma outcomes. So joint probability. But there's actually, I want to just emphasize the three different points of view that you can take. So there's the one I just outlined where you look at joint probabilities, probability of incomes and outcomes. But you could also look at have a time forward point of view where you're interested in the probability of outcomes given incomes. So if I go back, you might be interested in the probability of Y and Z given some particular value of X being sent in. And you can also have a time backwards point of view where you're interested in the probability of incomes given certain outcomes. The standard operational framework for quantum theory is in the time forward point of view. I think one of the points of this talk is that the time symmetric point of view is actually more natural. And that's the point of view I want to take. Of course, if you've got these joint probabilities, then you can use them to calculate conditional probabilities using the usual rules of probability theory. And actually also, if you have the conditional probabilities, then you can go back and calculate joint probabilities. So you can interconvert from answers you have in each of these points of view given appropriate information. So I'm going to take the time symmetric point of view and look at these incomes, outcomes, joint probabilities. And one thing I want to demand is that we get the same answer for these joint probabilities, whether we do the calculation forward in time or we do the calculation backwards in time. Okay. Right. So,
question?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Can you formulate this as an experimental test of whether your hypothesis of the time reversal is true?
I think there could be an experimental test. I hadn't thought about that. It's a good question. I think to formulate it, what you would want to do is to actually maybe here. So this is the next thing, is the definition of time symmetric theory. And then you can imagine doing experiments coming out of this. So the way to do it, so if I remember, I'll try and address your question after I've talked through these next two slides. So here's the definition of what I mean by a time symmetric theory. So if operational theory is time symmetric, if the following two things hold, first of all, for every allowed operation, there's a map to a time reverse operation, which is also allowed. Okay. So you have this map, which is indicated by the tilde. And also you can see that the inputs and outputs have been swapped and the incomes and outcomes have been swapped. Okay. So you've inverted that in time. So you need that condition. And the second condition is that you have any circuit E, then you can obtain the time reverse circuit just by inverting the graph and replacing operations with their time reversed counterparts. I'll give an example on the next slide. And then you require that the probability of a circuit and its time reverse are the same. So here's an example. So here's the circuit I discussed earlier. And then the time reverse of that circuit is this. So I've sort of turned it upside down and replaced and put tildes. And we require that the probability is the same for these two circuits. This is the joint probability. So this means that every process that's described in the forward direction, there should be a corresponding process described in the opposite, in the backwards direction. So I think that might be the basis for an experimental test. You'd have to characterize the space of these operators and show that that this correspondence existed, which time reversed them, and check that you got the right probabilities. Exactly how you do that, I don't know, because you'd have to have some inequalities to show that you were. You had a good result, but that would be the basis for experimental test. Okay, so here are the contents of this talk going forward. I'm going to talk about some double properties for a simple classical situation. And then I'm going to talk about physicality conditions for general operational theories. So remember, I talked about those physicality conditions on the very first slide after the title page in time asymmetric quantum theory, the usual ones. But there's in a time symmetric case, you end up with these physicality conditions. And then I'm going to address quantum theory, talk about quantum theory, and I'll talk about various things there. So in using operators and expressing the physicality conditions in terms of operator tensors. There's a curious thing that happens here that you get these gauge parameters that crop up and you can choose any values for these gauge parameters. They are gauge parameters, but they are some different choices are more suited to making either the time forward, the time backwards, or the time symmetric point of view seem clearer. And then I'll show you a time symmetric extension theorem. So there is in operational quantum theory the Steinspring extension theorem that shows how you can basically extend any operation, write it down in a form that uses a unitary operator, and then you trace over some environment. But that usual conception of the Steinspring extension theorem is time asymmetric, so we need to prove a time symmetric extension theorem. I won't have time to show you the details of the proof. But in some ways, I think it's more satisfactory. The time symmetric theorem is more satisfactory because the proof, I think, is it makes use of the time forward and the time backwards. I think gives a better proof of the sort of possibility of this unitary expansion. And then if I get time, I'll just show you, one of the things you can do is consider the time reverse of various experiments that we consider, like Bell's theorem or whatever. And one acute example is the time reverse of teleportation. Okay. Oh, so just before I move on, there's been lots of work, of course, on time symmetry in quantum theory. And it would be hopeless to try and summarize all of that research. This is some of the relevant work. So Aharonov, Bergman, and Leibovitz showed how to formulate pure state quantum theory, so Hilbert space quantum theory, in a time symmetric fashion. And in some ways, I mean that's so. There was this question: is quantum theory symmetric in time or not? The collapse of the wave function made it look like it might be time asymmetric, and for a while it looked like this. This paper settled that question, that you could actually construe standard quantum theory in a time symmetric fashion. But then this paper, this condition I mentioned, the Pavia causality condition by Giulio Chiarella, Mara De Rauno, and Paolo Veronotti, showed actually that the conditions on operators are time asymmetric. And so we're back to the situation where it looked like quantum theory was really time asymmetric, or at least the operational formulation for density matrices and so on. And then more recently, there's been a bunch of papers on thinking about time symmetry. So the first person to do this in recent years was Anil Oreshkov and Nicholas Scherf. So this paper, 2015, and then in the last year or so, there's been a bunch of different things. So so we had Andrea DiBaggio talk at Perimeter in December, and he's going to be coming here as a postdoc. So in this paper, DiBaggio, Donner, and Ravelli showed in some way what they did inspired in part what I did. And there was some early discussion between me and DiBaggio and Ravelli as part of the KISS program. But what they do is a bit different. I talked about this three different points of view: the time symmetric, the time forward, and the time backwards. They don't discuss the time symmetric point of view. They show that the time forward point of view and the time backwards point of view are can be mapped into one another. So they prove a sort of time symmetry in that way. Okay. And then there's been a few papers by Giulio Chirabella and collaborators recently, which I think are very interesting. And the other thing that's relevant to the work that I'm going to talk about is a process theory. So the sort of stuff that's been done by Bob Kirker and various collaborators, and also Peter Selinger, early papers by him. And it's summarized in the book by Kirker and Kissinger. Although I won't have time to talk about it, the machinery, the mathematical machinery that those guys set up is relevant to prove, in particular, the extension theorem. Okay, so let's talk about some double properties for a simple classical situation. So a double property is going to be a property where we have a forward version of a property and we have a backwards version of the property. And so those two versions are so basically the inversions of one another. So first of all, I want to describe a simple classical situation. So imagine we have a bunch of operations wired together like this, wired together by the physical systems, and we leave the incomes and outcomes open. So if you take something like this, then we can collapse all this down. We can just collapse this into one big box like this. And now we have some incomes on here, over here, and outcomes over here. And this box M is classical, though, of course, it's got some physics, maybe quantum physics hidden inside it. And then we can just make this even a bit simpler and use this notation where U represents the composite system going in and V represents the composite system going out. So we have this box. Okay, so this is a very simple classical situation, but it holds the key to getting started on understanding time symmetry. So I'm going to show you a result. I call it double distribution uniqueness. So imagine you have that box I just discussed here, with some income and some outcome. And now what I'm going to do is I have some distribution coming in over possible incomes. And I'm going to describe this in the forward point of view. Okay, I have a distribution over incomes coming in. So that's represented by some distribution over U's. And then I have some outcome going out, and that's represented by a conditional probability for each income U. I have a certain probability of an outcome. Okay, so I can calculate the joint probability for this circuit in the forward direction, and it's equal to this expression here. Okay. But I can think about this in the backward time direction instead. So now I have some distribution over V's coming in from the future. And then I have the conditional probability for each V a certain U. And I can calculate the joint probability of for this circuit in that way as well. And I want these two probabilities to be equal, because it shouldn't matter whether I calculate the probability in the forward time or the backwards time direction. So we get this condition. Okay, and so we can do the same thing, but instead of having E and F, I have E prime and F prime, so different distributions on the front and the back. Okay, so now let me take these two equations with and without the primes, and I'm going to divide them as long as some appropriate things are non-zero. And then you can use this and the fact that probabilities have to add to one to show that the income distribution has to be the same in each of these two cases. And likewise, the outcome distribution has to be the same. The condition on non-zero probabilities is this. So if you want to get the same answer, whether you do the calculation forwards in time or backwards in time, then actually you have to have some given, you have to restrict yourself to having the same, some given input distribution and some given output distribution. Okay. And I have to admit, I noticed your question, Rob, I'll come to it. This is something that I struggled with for a long time, but I eventually I made my peace with this. It sort of makes sense, really, because, you know, if you're going forwards in time and you can't anticipate what f is, if f can be different, then you're going to get different answers from when you go backwards in time. Okay, Rob, go ahead.
I just got a bit confused there. On the previous slide, I'm wondering if you think of this, the final equation, as a kind of substantive constraint on physical theories, because it I look at it and I think that this is just a commitment to classical probability theory, to say that, you know, the joint distribution can be decomposed in either of these two ways. It doesn't seem to be any kind of statement about the physics. So have I got that right, first of all, that it's not a constraint on the physical theory?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So I think the answer is yes. Maybe it sounds like there's a second part to your question.
Well, the second question is kind of unrelated to this one, that because it sounded like you were trying to define some concept like double distribution uniqueness, but and maybe that's what you're building up to, that this is kind of a given for all physical theories that this would be true, like what you have on this slide.
So yes. I think in the end, all this is saying is if you want to have a time symmetric point of view on these circuits, then you have to actually send in some particular distribution over the incomes and likewise some given distribution has to be sent in backwards in time over the outcomes. If you send in distributions which are different from that, then you're going to get different answers whether you do the calculation forwards in time or backwards in time. So in some sense, the constraint that you want to get the same answer in either direction basically is going to constrain you to a certain fixed choice of distributions.
Okay.
So what one could say, and that means the world is like that. You can't prepare things that aren't like that. So really it depends on what you want to do with this. You could say, well, the time symmetric picture is just a point of view. And if you stick to that point of view, you have to have these particular distributions on the input, on the incomes and the outcomes. But you can choose different points of view where you don't have that. Maybe I'll discuss that a bit later.
So I got something out of that last answer, which the sense in which I feel like this final equation would have sort of no content beyond just a commitment to classical probability theory. I think that's true only if you're interpreting all of these probabilities in a kind of subjective Bayesian way, that if the distribution is just my knowledge of what's going on with you, then this is just a statement about different ways of writing down my knowledge. But when you said something like I can send in a distribution, it seems to me that you're thinking about these distributions over U and V maybe somewhat differently as sort of describing, I don't know, some objective stochasticity or some sort of intervention that somebody has made, such that there's some like variability in the world, and it's not just about an agent's beliefs. Have I got that right?
I mean, generally in my work, I try to avoid any commitment to a particular interpretation of probability. And I think these are just equations that you'd write down in standard probability theory. There's nothing unusual about them. So I think any interpretation of probability, you could regard these equations as holding or not.
But I think the answer to the question I just asked, it will be important what your interpretation is, because if you're gonna say that these probabilities are propensities, then you might say this equation on this screen is a constraint on the type of physical theory you're considering. But if you're going to say that they're only subjective degrees of belief, then it's not a constraint on the physical theory.
I think even if they're propensities, I'm saying that this equation is a constraint on being able to take a certain point of view, a time symmetric point of view. So if this constraint doesn't hold, then you can't take this time symmetric point of view. So so I think there's more to be said about this. So it might be good to have this discussion after I've talked about conditional reference frames at the very end. Perhaps if we can return to it then.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's something where I don't have complete clarity myself, by the way. So it's a place where I think a lot more discussion is needed. Laurent, you had a question.
Yeah, elementary question. I'm not sure I completely understand what E refer to, because you seem to say that PE is unique. It's like there's only one E, but initially you were thinking, you know, U is a set of settings. So how do you control your setting by a probability distribution? I'm kind of, which becomes
so U, I'm calling these incomes rather than settings. And I imagine that you have some, for example, some box which randomly chooses some setting U, not setting, sorry, some income U. If you regard this in the sort of forward in time direction. Any box that does that would work. You know, experimentalists have boxes that produce random numbers.
But are you saying that therefore there's only one possible box for?
Yes, so I'm saying that if you want to satisfy this condition that you get the same probability forwards in time as backwards, then actually it modulo this assumption with the very bottom, then there's only really one box.
So do I conclude from that let's say if my choice of settings is not, or input is not random, like you know, there's one experimenter choosing one and another one, mm-hmm. then they are going to be different. So are you saying that as soon as there's two experimenters in the world, then I need to have a time asymmetric picture? Is that the conclusion?
No, I wouldn't say that.
In that case, there would be two PEs, right?
And anyone who has,
that's maybe my confusion.
Yeah. So you're asking if different people might have different probability distributions for the same situation.
Different sets of settings and different way to choose them and assign.
Yeah, well, I mean, all I'm saying is, if you want to have this property that you get the same property when you calculate it forwards in time or backwards, then this has to be true. So if one person has that and another person doesn't, then I think then we have a problem. So maybe if I continue a bit, this might become clearer, and then we can come back to this.
Okay.
So one way to achieve double distribution uniqueness is to consider only flat distributions. So we imagine that we only allow boxes on the incomes, which are flat distributions. I'm going to often in the literature, people use this Earth symbol. I don't like the Earth symbol, but I've just put it there because it might be familiar to people. So this would be a distribution with equal weight on each of the incomes, regarded forward in time. And this would be a distribution with equal weight on each of the outcomes regarded backwards in time. Okay, so to achieve double distribution uniqueness, we can consider only flat distributions. And then the second thing is to impose double flatness. I'll say what double flatness is in the next few slides. This property that I'm going to describe, double flatness, holds in quantum theory, and it's deeply related to causality properties. Okay. So what this means is, if you want to get time symmetric probabilities, the first point is that you have to put all the boxes have to be on the ends have to be these R boxes, which correspond to flat distributions. So here's double flatness. Double flatness, let me just look at the pictures, the words just describe it. Okay, but double flatness is the, so forward flatness is the property that if I send a flat distribution in, then I get a flat distribution out. Okay, and backwards flatness is if I is the same property but in the opposite direction in time. If I send a flat distribution in from the future, then I get a flat distribution out at the past. So this probability this property is true for unitary evolution, and construed in the right way, it's true for quantum theory generally. Okay. And another way to express double flatness is this property, I call it double summation. So if you have a circuit like this, it's basically, you could almost think of these as being matrix elements with labeled by U and V. If I sum over the U's, then I should get the same number 1 over NV for each V. And so that's forward summation. Backward summation is the same property, but where you sum over the V's. And this is equivalent to double flatness. And it's related to bistochasticity. There's a more general property than being bistochastic, where a matrix may not be square, it may be a rectangular matrix. And if you add the rows, if you add the columns, then you get one constant. And if you add the rows, you get another constant. So it's that kind of property that we have here. Okay, so let me discuss now some physicality conditions. So previously, physicality conditions in the original, on the first slide after the title page, I had these two conditions: complete positivity and a trace non-increasing condition. And those conditions guarantee, the first condition guarantees that your probabilities are greater than zero. And the second condition guarantees that your probabilities are less than one, less than or equal to one. So here we have something slightly different. So again, the first condition is the same. It guarantees that probabilities are greater than one, so greater than zero, greater than or equal to zero. But the second condition has to do a bit more. It has to guarantee double summation, or equivalently double flatness. So I want to impose physicality conditions which do this. And you'll see there's two physicality conditions we have. One is complete positivity, which is imposed by a condition called T positivity in this general time symmetric framework. And the second one is double summation. And that's imposed by a condition called double causality. Okay, so notice I'm not doing great on time. So I'm going to skip past, let me think. I'll skip past the T positivity part of the condition because it's not really different from the time asymmetric case. So let me talk about this though. So a theory has a forward spanning property. If you have, consider this preparation. So this, if you take a general preparation for a system, you can write it in this form. You just collapse all the circuitry that appears behind into one box. So you have this. And I'll say that a theory has the forward spanning property if any arbitrary system preparation like this is equivalent to a weighted sum of income only preparations. So I want it to look like this. So I'm skirting here over what I mean by equivalent, and that's explained in great detail in the paper. But there's a certain notion of equivalence that you can set up very naturally. And the idea here is you'd think that you should be able to prepare, you know, your whole space should be spannable just by things that concern sending stuff into a box. And you shouldn't have to need this stuff that comes after the box. Okay. There's a similar property called the forward purity property where you insist that the weights are non-negative, but I won't use that. Okay, and then there's a backward spanning property, which is the same thing, but in the time reverse direction. Okay, and there's a backwards purity property. So theory has the double spanning property if it has both forward and backward spanning properties. And we use this property to obtain double causality. There's also some discussion about T positivity, which I'm going to skip. Quantum theory has all these double properties. Okay, so I'm going to skip T positivity. Right, so I want to talk, before I come on to double causality, which is perhaps the most important result in this work, I want to describe what I call ignore preparations and ignore results. So an operation that has only an input, has none of these other things, is called an ignore result. And more often in the literature, people use this IRF symbol to represent those, but I don't like that notation. And similarly, an operation that has only an output, I'm going to call that an ignore preparation. You're ignoring anything that happens before. You can prove that these things are unique using the double spanning property. And I'll skip the actual proof, it's very straightforward. Okay, so now double causality. So you can show it follows from double flatness and double spanning that a general operation satisfies two conditions. This is the forward causality condition and the backwards causality condition. These two conditions taken together constitute constitute what I call double causality. Okay, so maybe it's worth staring at this a little bit. So this says you have an operation and you send into it, you ignore the past and you ignore the income, or you send in the flat distribution. The thing you get out is just the ignore on the outputs system and the flat distribution on the outcome system. Likewise, you have this in the reverse time direction. Okay. And if these conditions hold for all the operations comprising a circuit, then you have the circuit will satisfy double summation or double flatness. Are there any questions on this condition, on these conditions? No. Okay. So the idea is that these conditions are supposed to replace the Pavia causality condition. These are, in some sense, the time symmetric conditions, and they replace, in a time symmetric theory, the Pavia causality conditions. And one thing you can do is you can regard various of these wires here as null, which means you just ignore them. And so you have lots of different versions of these double causality conditions. So this is the original, these are the original versions. And then if you delete various of the wires, you get lots of different versions. So one version, for example, on the next slide is the double flatness conditions. So you can get double flatness back from double causality. And this condition here is the Pavia causality condition. So you can get the Pavia causality condition back from the double causality condition. Okay. Here's something that you can prove. Imagine you have this configuration. So you have an outcome here and an income here. Well, you can replace each of these boxes by equivalent boxes using the double causality conditions. And you get this. And this thing in the middle is just equivalent to one. It gives probability one. So then you prove that you have this condition. So you have this thing here is equivalent to the flat distribution over this x and the flat distribution over this y. And they kind of point in opposite directions in time. And this shows essentially that you can't really, there's no information traveling along this Z shape. In fact, the sort of, I put inverted commas around the word signaling, but the sort of, the signaling possibilities are, if you consider these various simple situations. So this situation here is by forward flatness, it's equivalent to just having a flat distribution over each of these outcomes. So there's no signaling there. This one is equivalent to having a flat distribution over each of these incomes here. So it's also has is equivalent to flat. So there's no signaling there. This one I just discussed, there's no signaling. Whereas this one, you can get information from here across here in principle. Okay. So let me show you how to use double causality to prove that a circuit satisfies, in this case, backwards flatness. So here's not a circuit because it's got some open wires. Here's an arrangement of operations, but I have some open income wires. And I want to prove that that's equal to this. So what you can do is you can go through and you can replace sequentially the operations by their equivalent forms using the double causality condition. So first of all, I can replace this by this one. There's a property that this ignore operation factorizes. And then I can now move over to here and I can replace this one here by the equivalent expression, and I keep going. I replace over here, and then finally I get to this, which is the thing I was trying to prove. Okay. So to set up quantum theory, I find it's most natural to do this in this operator tensor framework, and I don't have time to set up the operator tensor framework, but basically what you have are operators, and then they have some wires coming out of them which sort of indicate the Hilbert spaces, in this case these are classical spaces that the operator acts on. And you can set up a correspondence from operations to operator tensors, so that if you take a circuit built out of operators, so out of operations, and you replace each of those operations by the operator tensor, then you get the correct probability for the circuit. So this is something you can do in the operator tensor framework. So physicality in quantum theory now boils down to these two conditions. There's a T-positivity condition, which is basically the same as the condition on the very first slide, except that I have now shown explicitly an income and an outcome. And the double causality condition, and that's different from the condition I showed you on the first slide. It's different from the Pavia causality condition. And you can see now that these conditions are time symmetric. So the conditions that constrain the allowed operations are time symmetric now, whereas they weren't time symmetric originally. Okay. Let's just look at the time. Right. So one thing that crops up here is you get these gauge parameters. So I think anyone who's thought about this, one curious thing you wonder about is, you know, if I'm going to, you think, well, the natural time reverse of the identity operator when you make a measurement like this is the density matrix corresponding to just noise, except that the identity operator, which gives you the trace, is just equal to the identity, whereas the density matrix corresponding to a totally mixed state is equal to the identity divided by n. So that seems to be a sort of time asymmetry, but it turns out that's just gauge, and you can introduce this gauge parameter, and you can choose any value you want for this gauge parameter alpha. It doesn't really matter in the calculations. There are some natural choices. If you're working in a time forward point of view, it's more natural to choose this value, but it doesn't matter what value you choose. If you're working in a time symmetric point of view, it's more natural to choose alpha equals one. And if you're working in a backwards point of view, it's more natural to choose alpha equals the square root of n. It doesn't really matter. And there's a similar gauge parameter associated with the incomes and outcomes. Okay, so here's the extension theorem. So the extension theorem says that all physical operators can be written in this extended form. So this is a bit like the Steinspring extension theorem, but it's time symmetric. Incidentally, something like this, slightly different, but similar to this, appears in the reconstruction of quantum theory by John Selby and co-authors. So it's been seen before. But here you can actually now prove a theorem. You can show that all physical operators, so that's to say operators that satisfy this T positivity condition and also the double causality condition, can be written in this form. Okay, and this is a time symmetric form. To prove that, you need to use the sort of the mathematical machinery of Kirke and Selinger that I mentioned at the beginning. And then interestingly, if you do that, if you have this particular extension theorem, then you can easily write down the time reverse of an operator. Just you turn the thing upside down and you take the adjoint of the unitary. And when you do that, you have to be careful because you get some of these gauge parameters that come in that you have to take care of. Okay. So maybe I'll discuss these conditional frames of reference just and then I'll conclude. So here's a circuit. And the probability, the joint probability for this circuit is this. So that's the thing you would naturally calculate. But you might be interested in the conditional probability. You know, in the forward point of view, you'd want to calculate the probability over outcomes given certain incomes. Okay, so to do that, you just use the standard rules of probability theory. So you have this, and then you divide it by this thing where you've basically summed over the outcomes, okay. And then this denominator, you can show by backward summation, backwards flatness, it's just equal to this here, 1 over n x, n y, n z. Which means that you can write this down like this, where I've now introduced a different notation for these on the incomes and outcomes. And the income notation here now has this n built into it. Okay, so if we go back here, I've got this denominator, but that means I'm multiplying by nx times ny times nz. And so I accommodate that here by building it into the definition of these boxes. For the backwards box, I leave it like it was. Okay. What you can do is you can say that when you do this calculation, you've gone into the forward conditional frame of reference. So you're conditioning on something different. And in this forward conditional frame of reference, you're naturally calculating the probability of outcomes given incomes. Using this notation. You can also go into a backwards conditional frame of reference where you just put the n factor on the other side. And that enables you to calculate the probability of incomes given outcomes. And you still have the sort of time symmetric conditional frame of reference, which is just where you don't have any n. And that one you use to calculate joint probabilities. So it seems, so you have this sort of framework. This is something I want to develop further, where different choices of conditional reference frame naturally enable you to calculate different sorts of probabilities. A natural question here is whether you can extend this to a continuum of conditional frames of reference, and I have ideas along those lines. You can show this framework is equivalent. So the time symmetric formulation is with the time symmetric double causality condition is equivalent to the usual, the standard operational framework, which is forwards in time. You can do that using thinking in terms of these conditional frames of reference. You can also get a sort of backwards version of quantum theory by transforming to the backwards conditional frame of reference. Yeah, I'm running slightly over, but there were lots of questions. So maybe just because it's kind of cute, here's an example. So you can take any experiment that you might consider, and you can invert it, consider it in the backwards time direction. So here's a teleportation protocol. So you have some Bell state. So if you get a certain value of x, then a certain Bell state is prepared here. And then you share it, then the entanglement goes off in its opposite directions. And then in comes the state you want to teleport on this wire. You perform a Bell measurement. That's the inverse, that's the time reverse of the Bell state preparation. And it has an outcome, which is this x here. And then you use that outcome to control a unit tree, and that will convert you into some ongoing state. You can model this box over here, this C box. You can model it like this. So here you have some control thing coming in that controls a unit tree on A, and then afterwards you trace over, you ignore the outcome. Well, if you turn that thing upside down, then you get this. So now what's happening is this also actually accomplishes teleportation, but it does it in a different way. So in the case where you get the certain value of x that you need, then this input will be teleported onto this output. So whatever comes in here will go out there. What's happening here, this C box, basically you're sending in random noise, and then that random noise selects a certain unitary transformation randomly, and then you read off the outcome, and you send that outcome, and you use that outcome to choose what entanglement you're going to share, what Bell basis you're going to use to share entanglement. So this is the sort of time inverse. Okay. So conclusions. So there's a lot of question. I think we had some of this discussion at the beginning about how we should interpret these results. In the first place, I want to just present it as these results as a mathematical results, and now we can try to put the interpretation on top of them. There's a question about porting classical information around. If you have these double flatness conditions in place, then it imposes constraints on how you can port information around. The theory of conditional reference frames is something I want to develop further. In the paper, there's a lot of work done on developing duotensor and operator tensor formulations, which I didn't discuss in any depth here. One question is whether we can use this approach to find better axioms for quantum theory. The other question is what's the interpretation of the double causality condition? It seems like it's telling you in some sense that you can't signal forwards in time or backwards in time. And finally, the actual motivation for this, although I haven't had any time to talk about this here, is to do with quantum gravity. Now, general relativity is time symmetric. And if you want to take an operational approach to quantum gravity using sort of operational quantum theory ideas, then it's unfortunate if quantum theory is time asymmetric. It would be better if it was time symmetric. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lucien, for this very interesting talk. So we had many questions, but I'm sure there are more. Yes, Rob.
Yeah, a very interesting talk. One obvious thing that it seems to me this should recover are things like the principle of detailed balance and so on. I mean, I gather that's been checked through, or it's probably straightforwardly follows from this formalism.
The truth is I hadn't heard of detailed balance until I came across it recently, and I've never studied it. So I don't know the answer to that question. It's something I had meant to look at in detail, so to speak, but I haven't done so. I don't know the answer to that question. If you get back to me in a few weeks, I'll maybe have an answer.
Okay. And one other thing, I mean, you've imposed this, what do you call it again, this condition where you've got to have the probabilities match.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one generalization that comes to mind is, what if you relax that condition a bit, that they match within some tolerance? Mm-hmm. Can the formalism still work, or does the whole thing just fall apart?
I mean, so I think the general idea I have for relaxing it is to go to these conditional frames of reference where you'd expect it not to, where you wouldn't require them to match. And so I want to develop this theory of conditional frames of reference. And I'm working on that at the moment. So I don't have a good answer at this stage, but I think there is going to be a very interesting theory here. It incidentally connects to the fact that these operators are tensors, so have a kind of tensor-like structure. And so transforming into a different conditional frame of reference, I think, will imply transforming your operator tensors in some way as well. So you could certainly consider, if that works, you could consider small transformations. So you're basically at the time symmetric, in the time symmetric conditional frame of reference, but slightly away from it, and then this thing should hold approximately. But I need to think about this much more carefully.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. And well, now Rob, but yeah.
Thanks. And I'm wondering if you could go back to your slide on flatness.
On double flatness. Okay. Okay, what's just happened there? Many slides. Okay. So these are the slides on double flatness.
Yeah, what came right before this? Sorry, I'm trying to remember what.
This one, maybe.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. So I think I maybe I misunderstood. Because I it seemed to me like when you said that this holds in operational quantum theory, that didn't sound right to me, because it's essentially like what you described early on, that you know, if I have a map that's a completely positive map that's trace preserving, it might not be unital. It might not take the complete mixed state to the complete mixed state.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, its adjoint will be unital. If in the forward direction it's trace preserving, then in the backward direction it's going to preserve the complete mixed state. But it doesn't have to preserve the complete mixed state in the forward direction. Mm-hmm. So it. I mean, but what you said later suggested to me that you were maybe thinking of restricting, like imagining a Stein spring dilation of the channel and then restricting the ancilla to necessarily be in a completely mixed state. And that's why the overall channel is unital. I guess my question is a little bit, if you bring it, what you said here, back to the language of complete positive maps and, mm-hmm. and properties like trace preservation, unitality. What's going on?
Let's see. So maybe we should go back. We should go to that extension. Okay, here. So you want to have noise coming in here, but you also have this income and this outcome, and I'm not sure that normally easily fits into this language of unital operations. Perhaps you can make it work.
But if you make X and Y trivial.
Okay, well then, okay, so then you have, let's see, then you have, then I guess you have a unit operation. Is that right, in both directions? I mean, if you send the identity in, you'll get the identity out, yes. But the interesting thing is not having these things trivial, because this is what enables you to interact with the physics, is by having incomes and outcomes that you can extract probabilities.
Sure. I guess I'm sort of at a level of just trying to understand maybe even the simplest cases. Is your claim that, like, if I write down a CP map that's trace preserving but not unital,
mm-hmm.
Are you trying to say, you know, that map's not allowed in the theory, or are you trying to say?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So here's an example of a map, which I think is like that. So just the projection map, Yes, is that something like that? Yeah, so it projects a trace, but that's actually not trace specific, that's trace decreasing.
It may be like, you know, in the block ball, there's a map that'll take all the states in the block ball down to the ground state. Say it's a two-level atom. So there's a map that takes everything to the ground state. And so it takes particularly the complete mixed state to the ground state. And so it's not preserving the complete mixed state.
So if you try to, if you do a Steinspring extension on that, you'll have some ancilla prepared in a given state coming in, and then a unitary operation, and then a unitary operation. And that doesn't fit into this form, this frame, into this. You can't expand that like this, because here you have to have the totally mixed state going in on the ancilla. So that kind of thing doesn't work in this kind of time symmetric frame of reference. Now you can model it if you go and if you transform to the time forward frame of reference, where you then allow yourself to put a box on here that would do that in the sort of time forward point of view. But in the time symmetric point of view, you can't do that. And so, yeah, so there are different allowed operators. Although these things are equivalent, they give you the same predictions for any situation. So this is equivalent to standard quantum theory. It's just that you're packaging the theory up in a different way.
So if I can just have a short follow-up, from what you just said, I'm wondering if it would be fair to characterize your attitude towards, you know, non-unital channels to be analogous to the what they say in the DiBaggio et al. Paper, which is that, you know, and normally we see this time asymmetry, you know, we have non-unital channels going forward but not backwards, simply because we tend to have more information about the past than about the future. You know, we tend to not be post-selecting on things in the future, but we could post-select on things in the future, and then that would recover our time symmetry. So you know, that your X and your Y here allow you to have, you know, counterparts. If you condition on Y in the same way that you've conditioned on X, then you can recover time symmetry for the cases of maps that are non-unital.
So yeah, so one can certainly say that. Although, I mean, to the difference, but the thing extra that everything I've done is completely sympathetic to the point of view that Andrea et al. Put forward, and I know suddenly there's a fair amount of inspiration from that work. But the extra thing is that you have this time symmetric point of view where you're calculating conditional probabilities over incomes and outcomes. And in that framework, you would have this constraint. This is how your operators would look. But now, yes, but then within that, you can now condition either put a box here, so you're conditioning in the time backwards direction, or you can condition in the time forward direction. So then you recover that kind of symmetry as well. There's two different notions of time symmetry here. One is sort of a point of view which is just time symmetric by itself. And another is a time symmetry where you say, well, I've got a time forward point of view, and I can also map to a time backwards point of view. And there's a symmetry between those two different points of view. So all of those things work here. But I prefer to be in the frame of reference, or the conditional frame of reference, where it's just time symmetric by itself in some sense. Does that help answer those questions?
Yeah, thanks.
Flamini, you're chairing, I guess.
Yeah. So we have a question by Laurent.
Hello, Lucien. Hello. I think I have questions maybe about some of the premise of the formalism. Mm-hmm. That is, it's about this dichotomy you have a system which contains both classical and quantum input.
Yeah.
So one is really a very naive question. I'm really confused by this notion of flat distribution for classical input, in the following sense that quantum mechanics, I know what I would mean by that. I just count the number of states, my Hilbert space is very clean. At the classical level, it seems to me that this notion is really dependent on my perspective, on my ability to subdivide my system into subsystems. Suppose I have NP balls and I count them equally, that's flat. But then I realize, oh, I forgot a quality about them. their mass or their color or something, and then suddenly my distribution, which was flat in one perspective, is no longer flat in the other. So is that fair that somehow this notion of, and a lot of seems to be relying on this notion of flat distribution, but in the classical world, there's not one way to define what you mean by a flat distribution. It's completely ambiguous. Is that?
I mean, this is a very simple situation, considering where you have sets of incomes and outcomes. Let's see. I think So you're saying that
I'm saying that the notion of flatness depends on my coarse graining, for instance.
Right. Okay. So, it's very
perspectival. Like.
Yeah. So certainly, I'm considering the case where you have a finite set of incomes, and given to you, but you're right. Okay. So you could even, with a finite set of incomes, you could consider coarse graining them in a different way, and then get to a different finite set of incomes. This is something I thought about a bit. So there's a certain maximality property that you can demand, that your incomes and outcomes satisfy a certain maximality condition, so that they're in some sense maximal with regard to the most fine-grained level, and I discussed that a bit in the paper. But you could have a problem if you start off with one thing and then coarse grain them. That's true. Yeah. So I am assuming that you're at the most fine-grained level for this situation.
Okay. But maybe there's a limit. Okay. And then the problem is that if you start to fine-grain too much, you might leave the classical regime and enter the quantum regime.
Well, I mean, so it's true that classical systems are ultimately can subdivide them more and more, but the most fine grained level within the context of how you're setting up these operations.
Okay.
So for example, if you look at this extension here, have X coming in, and then it has a box which prepares a system in a basis state and comes up here. So I could introduce extra X's. But when it addresses this box, it can't produce extra elements in this basis set. Mm-hmm. So there's some maximal fine graining that's useful. So that's what I call the double maximality condition, kind of addresses that. It speaks to the most fine grained possible way of understanding the incomes and outcomes.
Okay, so in fact, I had a question about that hook operator, which seems very interesting. So you're saying you conclude that there's an operator that maps classical data, classical input to quantum input. And I have questions about, is that this big map X, is that, I don't know, how does that, can you tell more about it? Is that unique? What's this mapping, and what are the consistency of this mapping between the classical and the quantum world, and what are the properties?
I mean, it's quite... So this kind of box here, and likewise this box, this box, let's say, if I send a certain income in, then it will prepare a certain basis state from some basis set of states. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that exists, that you have these kinds of boxes. And then over here, it's kind of the reverse. If I know that my state is in a basis set, then this box will identify which basis state it is.
So you're just assuming that such a box exists, and commit it's unique, or it has consistency property, or
I mean, the one consistency property I demand is that if you send this here into the inverse box with an X, so if I send an income box into the inverse box, then I get the identity. I'm not sure how to. There is a constraint, a consistency condition that these things. If I send X in bottom, I don't know if you can see this. This condition here. So if I send in X at the bottom, and then I send it through these boxes, I should get X out at the top. So it's just the identity on the classical wire. Anyway.
Okay. And what about superposition? If I have a superposition, I mean, how does that inform the, I don't know, the measurement?
Superposition
the resistance of this box, how does that interfere with the measurement?
I mean, you could send an X box into a box that measures in a different basis, X prime.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you would no longer have this. You no longer have this identity, this equality with the identity with identity channel.
Okay.
Yeah.
And by maximum, there you mean?
I just mean a basis set. So it projects onto a basis set. Yeah. So either a maximal, if it's a maximal preparation, it prepares an element of a basis set. Or if it's a maximal result like this, then it measures onto that basis set of states and it tells you which one you have. So that's called maximal, which relates to this fine-grained idea, that it's the most fine-grained measurement.
Okay. Do we have more questions? Yes, Ding.
Thanks, Lucien, for this very nice talk. I guess I also have some maybe naive questions. I wonder, can you eliminate the distinction between the X and Ys and the A's and the B's? Can you, for example, embed the classical distributions as quantum distributions on some preferred basis?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this would give you a more economic description of the whole formalism.
Yeah, I mean, so one thing you could do is you can make the wires, the ones that come out to the side, you can make them go up and down instead. And then you could say they were quantum systems, but you restrict yourself to measuring in a basis, perhaps, and that would give you the same thing. Or you could say, well, you can have, you make the wires go up and down instead of left and right. And you say that these are just now inputs and outputs, and then you can allow different types of systems, so classical, quantum, or whatever you have. So you can certainly do that. I struggled for a while as to whether I should have these wires coming out the side or up and down. It doesn't really make a difference, except that it changes the way you think about this. And in the end, I decided I wanted to emphasize that these things are playing a special role. Because these are the things you're calculating your probabilities over, so I had them come out the side. Yeah.
Thanks, that helps. A follow-up, if I look at something in particular, like the forward and the backward causality conditions,
mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, there you have flat distribution as putting in the X, and then you have the maximally mixed state putting into A.
Yeah.
Right. If I apply the procedure that we just discussed, turn the X into a quantum system,
mm-hmm.
does that mean I just have an identity
as
the input, and then?
Yeah. So you could bring this. You could bring this box down, so have that wire going up, and bring this box up, so have that wire going down, and then this one goes up. So now you just have identity in, basically, gives you identity out, and vice versa. So if you keep this as classical, then you just have a hybrid system going in and a hybrid system going out. And in some ways, that's maybe a more natural way to regard this double causality condition. You still have the Pavia causality condition for the backwards one, but the forwards one, you also have you have the same thing in the reverse time direction. So you can certainly think in that way.
What about the other conditions? Do they change as well?
This one.
On the previous slides, you mentioned a lot of, conditions that you didn't
go. Oh, right. Okay. I had a table of lots of conditions which contained pretty much all the conditions. Yeah, I mean, so most of the conditions I've discussed, well, let's see, many of the conditions, like double flatness is this condition down here. Or is it this? Sorry, it's this one actually here. Yeah, you could, it would stay the same. It maybe is a different way to regard it. Yeah, I mean, there's some confusion perhaps in having wires going horizontal and vertical. So there's definitely a choice to be made there.
For example, if I look at the second to last and the third to last, and if I apply the above procedure, do they become the same condition?
So you mean same as second to last and third to last?
Yes.
That's this one and this one. Yeah, so they would then look the same, except that the way I've set it up, this is classical and this is quantum. But apart from that, they're the same condition, yes.
I see.
But nevertheless, this is all true, but if you want to interact with the physical world, you have to extract classical information. And so there is a special role that these things are playing. But yes, the condition is essentially the same.
Yes, a follow-up. I wonder the status of R, because when it enters, if I think of the first slide that R shows up, it seems it's a choice you made. Is that correct? You mentioned one way to achieve double distribution uniqueness is to use an R.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? You made a choice there.
Yeah, so let's soon go back to this slide where you make that choice. Okay. Yeah, this slide. So one way to achieve it, yeah, is to do this. I could have made a different choice. And so I think there's some potential, there's something to be studied here. So perhaps instead of studying a flat distribution, you might want to choose like a Gaussian distribution or something else. Now, if you do that, it doesn't hold in quantum theory to sort of, I mean, at least the usual finite dimensional quantum theory, because there's a proof in the paper showing that, you know, the unitary operators, for example, satisfy double flatness. And you really want this condition to make the whole thing work. But perhaps you could change things in such a way that there's a more natural distribution that goes in and out. You probably would want the condition to have some sort of factorization properties. So, you know, if you have two flat distributions, then that's just a flat distribution over the composite. But then that would be true actually for a more general set of distributions like Gaussian distributions, perhaps. So yeah, there's definitely scope for some physics there to look at what happens and how this changes if you consider non-flat distributions as your basis, as what you send in and out.
Is it correct that if I choose another distribution like a Gaussian, then a double flatness doesn't hold in quantum,
there may be a way to construe quantum theory whereby double Gaussianness, whatever it would be called, does hold. But looking at the proofs I have, it seems that quantum theory unitary operators in particular really pick out flatness as a special case. But you know what, I think that there might be a way to change things so that does hold. I think that could be very interesting, actually.
So suppose I don't want to change anything. I just want to understand why R is picked out uniquely. Is there an explanation? Discarding something?
So I've accidentally stopped sharing my screen. I'm gonna go into a different screen, see if I can get to the paper. Okay, sorry, this may take me longer than I was expecting. Okay, here. So here's, make this a bit smaller. That's maybe too small. Okay, I'll share this screen. Okay. So this is the proof that double flatness holds in quantum theory. So what you can do is you can start off with some circuit like this, and then you replace each of these operator tensors by the by their extension, okay, using the extension theorem. You have done that. And then you can stretch the wires. So now you have this, okay. And now you just have inside this dotted square box, you just have a unitary operator, you know, acting on all these wires. So this is one big unitary. So basically this whole circuit is equivalent to a circuit like this. And now you can see this circuit will satisfy the double flatness property. I'm not sure how obvious that is to you, but if you send in, so here's C and F, these are the this is the income and the outcome labels, and I send in noise here, so it's fairly straightforward to see that this thing will satisfy double flatness. Okay, so if I sum over the C's,
can you remind me what double flatness is?
Okay, sorry, but let me call it if I let me call it instead, I think I had another name, the double summation. So if I sum over C, so I'm effectively just sending in an identity here, then the thing I just get a flat distribution over the Fs. Okay. And the reason for that is that this is a unitary.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that unitary operators really want to be speaking to flat distributions. If I make these things non-flat, then that doesn't seem to work. But there may be something you can do. Perhaps you can change to non-unitary operators, but have some special property so this is true. Or perhaps there's some way to make this work. I think that would be interesting to look at. But this is the reason that you want to have double flatness for quantum theory. So yeah, the quantum theory really seems to care about double flatness.
Okay, thanks a lot. So maybe since it's been almost 1 hour and 40 minutes, maybe we should thank Lucien again for this very nice talk, and we can stop the recording, I guess.
Great, thank you.